From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 1782 when Benjamin Franklin eagerly handed out copies of a Boston newspaper. The big story was about the British hiring Native Americans to attack and scalp colonists. It angered readers, some of whom became more sympathetic to the revolutionary cause. The only problem is that it wasn't true. It was, yes, fake news. And apparently Franklin knew it. Longtime journalist and communication lecturer Mike Johansson referred to this incident in his recent piece about fake news. Johansson was pointing out that fake news is hardly a modern idea, but he goes on to say that we are largely to blame. Yes, us, you, me, all of us. Why? Well, we're going to get that for, I'm going to get that info from Mike this hour, and we're going to talk about whether we agree. Because I'm, well, some of the things I think he makes good points on, some of the things we're going to challenge. And let's go ahead and make clear that when we talk about fake news, what we are talking about is fabricated stories created to intentionally mislead, often for political gain. We are not talking about mainstream news outlets that we don't particularly like, though the issue has become the co-opting of the term fake news this year. So Mike Johansson's a senior lecturer in the School of Communication at RIT, and he's the reason we're here, longtime journalist in the world of Gannett and other journalistic outlets. Thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
We appreciate having you back here. Julie Phillip is senior engagement editor for the Democrat and Chronicle. Julie, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
And Randy Gorbman came a long way. The WXXI news director came across the hall for this.
And that carpet is in rough shape, so it was not easy getting over here. But not yes. Really. Glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, well, it's great to have all of us here. And, you know, I'm Mike, I have to say, you know, I think it was probably important to lay out your reasons for asking us to think, are we to blame? We're going to go over the six reasons Mike has first. You want to take me back to 1782, by the way, though? What was Benjamin Franklin doing?
I wasn't around at the time.
Well, I'm not trying to date you.
Well, I mean, it's just interesting, isn't it, that, you know, one of the founding fathers, as it were, wasn't below him to use a tactic like this. And, you know, through history, I mean, probably going back to the days of the cavemen. You know, we don't want to let people know where the great place to hunt is. We'll tell them it's somewhere else. Fake news.
So it is an effective tool. It is something that can be weaponized in some ways. And so what is your definition? Do you see the term being co-opted this year, Mike?
Oh, absolutely. And I think part of it is because there are so many shades of gray, if you like. There's out and out, as you say, fake news. Then there's misleading news. It's where something's been left out or overlooked, intentionally or otherwise. Then there's falsified stuff where people have literally taken someone at their word, not verified it. Then, of course, there's out-and-out satire, which, amazingly to me, people share as real news. I think I quote an example in one of my posts of the Beijing Evening News, sharing a story from Washington that Congress threatens to leave Washington unless they get a new building, written by The Onion.
Written by The Onion. Andy Borowitz gets passed around often as real
right,
stuff.
Yeah, right, exactly.
What the concern is with this, the Atlantic Monthly's Yuri Friedman points out in a piece last week under the headline, "The Real World Consequences of Fake News." And they write this. And again, we're not doing this to be political. We're just talking about sort of the current climate and the use of the term. And let's be clear, fake news has been used for a long time, but it's the current president who's really made that term specifically very popular, very sort of controversial and very common. And so The Atlantic writes the following, quote, "When Donald Trump's press secretary was recently asked to comment on a gallery of foreign leaders now embracing her boss's catchphrase of fake news, Sarah Sanders said, 'I'm not going to speak to specifics of another country when I don't know the details. The White House is concerned about false and inaccurate information being pushed out to mislead the American people.' But the phrase has escaped the confines of the American president's Twitter feed. Bashar al-Assad and other Syrian officials have trotted out the expression to reject evidence that the government summarily executed prisoners and massacred civilians with chemical weapons. The Chinese military just launched a website for the public to report fake news, including malicious posts about the People's Liberation Army, while the Russian Foreign Ministry now operates a webpage where international media reports that it considers problematic are slapped with a bright red fake stamp." So these are examples that the Atlantic Monthly are highlighting, Mike Johansson, as ways this term has been tossed around the world this year, in the last 12 months, to kind of discredit news. And we should be worried about that, should we not?
Right, because the minute you can sort of just simply dismiss something that you don't agree with as fake news, you give it the cachet of not being truthful or accurate. You sow seeds of doubt. And for people who don't really want to take the time to look for other sources, it becomes the truth, quote unquote.
I think Randy Gerbman, when we when we look at our place in the public media world and in the journalism world, we're proud of the standards we have. It doesn't mean that we think colleagues in other places are fake news, commercial or otherwise. That's the danger to me, is that the public starts thinking, well, if I don't like the source, it must be fake.
Yeah, and also I see a danger, and I'm just, you know, take, and obviously I agree with a lot of what we've been talking about up to this point, but I think one of the dangers with social media, and I just see this a lot with local media, I see with national media, is we're all in such a rush to make sure we don't miss a story, at least some media are, that we will retweet and share stories that, that it will later have to either retract or say that turns out that really wasn't the case. And I think it's also incumbent upon us in the news media to be careful about, even on social media, what we share or how we characterize it, or even just repeating it and then saying, well, I don't necessarily believe this, but you should know about it. I think it's irresponsible at times to put out stories that, frankly, you know how it is when people look at either social media or listen to the radio, watch TV, read the newspaper. Sometimes they'll hear the first version of something and not the second, third, or fourth, where something is retracted. So I think it's incumbent upon us also to be careful about what we share and how we discuss stories that are kind of out in the ether, so to speak, before we decide whether or not we're actually going to talk about them, whether we can vet them ourselves.
Julia Philip, in the last 12 months, what change have you seen with the way this term is used and the impact on the public?
I think it's not really changed. I mean, if you think back a decade ago, we were looking at emails that were doing the same thing. Remember, the emails went viral. The biggest change, obviously, is that now we have social media, so things can go much farther and much faster. And we have a president who really likes the words fake news, and he uses them very liberally. But he's not the first politician to, you know, use the tool, you know, if I just say it enough, it'll become true and people will stop questioning. But he's kind of labeled it as fake news. But I don't think it's a whole lot different, to your point. I think this has been around for a long time. It's just that we are dealing with it in a different form.
Well, we're going to ask Mike for his list, and we're going to work through the list for why Mike thinks that we are at least partly or largely to blame for the proliferation of fake news. But before we get there, I'm going to hopefully add a little inspiration to the conversation, because here's what I think the model should be when we do get it wrong. The problem is, if the public perceives us getting it wrong and being clumsy about it, then they're saying, well, you're biased, or you won't admit fault, or you're sloppy. Well, this is not from a journalist. It's from Jenna Fischer, who I think best known for playing Pam on The Office, but, you know, lots and lots of Twitter followers, and you know, she's very politically engaged. And here's what she posted just the other day. She wrote, "I've deleted a tweet and would like to issue an apology. Please read and retweet to help me spread the word." And what she wrote was this. She wrote, "I made a mistake and I want to correct it. After reading your feedback and doing additional research, I discovered that I tweeted something that was not accurate. Last month, the House of Representatives voted for a tax bill that did kill a $250 deduction for teachers to buy classroom supplies. But in the final bill, that deduction was restored. I feel genuinely bad about getting my facts wrong, and I'm sorry. I did not mean to spread misinformation. I was well-intentioned, but I was behind on my research. So I've deleted the tweet because I believe accuracy is important. Now, for a minute, I thought maybe I don't need to delete my tweet because it started a great dialogue about how teachers shouldn't have to go out of pocket to pay for school supplies. I love teachers, and I've started something important here. But listen, in fact, what I treasure most about our democracy is the dialogue we share with each other through conversation, social media, and the press. Part of having a dialogue involves listening and learning and admitting when you've been wrong. So, for me, tweet deleted. I'm not ashamed to say I was wrong, and I'm not ashamed to correct it." Jenna Fischer, owning it. That is, I don't see a whole lot of that, Mike Johansson. You're a social media guy.
Yeah, well, you don't. And part of,
I love that.
That's for two reasons. One is, we often miss, to Randy's point, people do correct things, but we miss the correction. That's another issue with social media. We're not paying close enough attention.
Or the correction doesn't get the same sort of pub or headline, right?
You know. Yeah, although that the semantic feeds that Facebook and Twitter are now doing has helped a little bit. So if you've liked something or reshared it, you are likely to see the follow-up post. So that's a little bit of help, but it's still not enough. So we do miss a lot of stuff.
Julie, what do you make of Jenna Fischer's comments there?
Well, I think it's important, and she's not a journalist, but I think one of the big problems is that the general public is unaware of the standards that journalists hold themselves to, the ethical, the standards, the vetting of sources. We don't use anonymous sources until we've had three, verifications, and all sorts of things that journalists do and take for granted that the world knows they do. And so now that people are beginning to question journalists who are human, who make mistakes in this 24/7 world where we're out there trying to be quick, we do go back and correct. But you have to actively go look at that story again to see the correction. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of room for the public to distrust us because we have never told them what goes into making real news versus fake news. So I think in a way it is a little bit of our fault for not making that clear. And it's a little hard, I think, for I know it's hard for the editors at the Democrat and Chronicle to talk about themselves. Journalists aren't very good at talking about themselves and standing up for themselves and explaining how they do their craft. And I think that has harmed us in this situation.
I was hoping to find something to disagree with, but I haven't so far. And I will turn to Randy Gorman and say...
to find something to disagree with?
We will. We're going to get there. But no, to Julie's point there, Randy, I think the more the public understands the process, the better here, because... For a number of reasons, mm-hmm. there is doubt or there is an assumption of just sloppiness or bias, and I think that it's important to pull it back a little.
And, you know, it's overused, cliche phrase, I guess you could say, but sausage making is what we often or sometimes refer to newsrooms.
Yeah.
And frankly, I've been in some other newsrooms, not this one, where I felt sometimes things were slapped together a bit more, you know, without a lot of oversight. But in any case, in any of our shops, you know, whether it be public, commercial, sometimes you are under time pressures, and sometimes things, and we've seen it happen recently, the CNN, other news organizations, ABC News, had a Brian Ross piece the other day, what he was suspended for. I mean, sometimes things do not get vetted, and you know, I like the fact Julie said, you know, at the DNC, they've got rules about three different ways to confirm, you know, an anonymous piece before they put it on the air. That doesn't happen all the time with a lot of places, A, and B, I think sometimes the pressure, and again, having worked both commercial and public, I've seen a bit more, at least in terms of broadcasting on the commercial side, the rush to get out, and you worked in commercial TV, I know,
yeah.
The rush to get out a story, I mean, you, I'm sure, had high standards, but sometimes your producer, your editors, whatever, you know, got to get it on the air, the other guys have it on the air now, we've got to do it now, and I think at least letting the public know in some fashion that we have some stopgaps, some ways to vet that kind of information, to confirm it, to corroborate it. I think you're right. I think we need to talk more about the process, and maybe, I don't know how we do that, but I think you make a good point in terms of doing that.
All right, so why does Mike Johansson think that there are reasons that fake news is our fault? And listeners, as you hear this, we'd love to hear from you. 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Do you want to see more of the behind-the-scenes process of how journalism is done? Do you feel like you understand the process well? Do you think fake news is our own fault, as you're about to hear why from Mike Johansson? You can call the program or you can email the program, connections@wxxi.org. And you just heard Randy Gorman, WXXI News Director. Julie Phillip is here, Senior Engagement Editor for the Democrat and Chronicle, and Mike Johansson, Senior Lecturer in the School of Communication at RIT. All right, so in Mike's piece, Six Reasons Fake News is Our Fault, I'm going to jump to the middle because I think this is one of the most important, and we're going to work through all six, though, Mike. You say we don't take the time to verify what we share. In other words, we see something and it is appealing, it's a headline we like, or it maybe bolsters a belief we have, and we either retweet it, we share it, we post it somewhere, and we are not taking very much time to say, wait, what's the source of this?
Right, and I think maybe it goes back to my days as a journalist, but I'm always skeptical first. I mean, I just don't accept on face value that this thing that looks, wow, this looks cool. Okay, so where did it come from? What's the source? You know, is the URL a legit website, or is it just something that's clickbaity, or is it, you know, I mean, there's all kinds of things. I think somewhere else I came up with 11 things you can do to verify whether something's fake or real, you know. So
And you know, I thought about challenging you on this. I thought about posting a story just to see if you'd retweet it. New study confirms Vegemite is the world's greatest food, which we know Vegemite...
Fake news.
That would be the fakest of news. Vegemite is...
I bet I could find some science for that.
Vegemite is disgusting. That's just science.
It's funny how that comes up every time I'm in the studio.
Wow. But Mike loves it, and he's trying to convert me on it. But what you're saying is, even though your bias is that Vegemite is somehow great, you wouldn't just retweet that or send that out there. You would say, well, who actually studied Vegemite here?
Right, right. And who's the source? And if the source is just, you know, XYZ Institute in some country I've never heard of, I'm probably not going to buy it. But if it was something from Australia, I'd say, okay, they've probably got inbuilt biases because it's an Australian product. where's the science here? What are they saying? Who's saying it?
This is where, Randy, I think social media has done harm, in that there in the past, before the world of the internet and social media, everybody had opinions, of course, mm-hmm. but it was harder to quickly share them. Now you see a headline that appeals to your bias, and you can crank it out there, and the velocity it picks up is pretty remarkable.
Yeah, and I'm just thinking as we're talking about that, to your point, Evan, and I'm not just picking on only politicians or people who work for various kinds of institutions, but we get, as I'm sure as Julie does and any media source, get tons, I mean, dozens and dozens. My inbox gets filled every day with press releases from, mm-hmm. Sometimes legitimate organizations, some not as well known, but they are often throwing out facts and figures. There are studies, as you know, health studies, studies about the economy, et cetera. And a lot of times, a lot of journalists, and I put myself in that camp as well. Again, if it was something of great interest, I might have, careful to attribute it to them, but putting out information without necessarily vetting it. I talk very often to our health reporter, Karen Chakurji, and thank God we have Karen on the staff, because she has a long background in doing health reporting and is very thorough. And a lot of times I'll get these studies that seem not quite something maybe as good as they should be, or even if it does look okay to me, I'll have Karen look at it and she'll say, they don't have XYZ verification, it's not a good clinical study, things like that. So there's a lot of areas as journalists we may not be expert in,
yep.
And we're kind of regurgitating some of the things we're getting and really shouldn't be, or at least if we are, we should make sure we say, hey, this has not been verified. And we get things like that all day long from every local, national, state politician, and not necessarily vetting those before they go on the air.
Mm-hmm. Julie?
Well, I think some of the fake news stories look really real. I mean, it's very difficult, even for a journalist. We have to sort of dig. For a regular person, I think it was, you might be aware of this, Mike, Stanford University did a study of middle, high school, and college students. And I think the word was shocked. The researchers were shocked at their inability to distinguish between real and fake news when it was presented to them. So we have kids growing up without the sort of media literacy skills that they need to distinguish. So to your point that it's our fault to some extent, but it's also the fault of these websites that look real. They sound real. They look real. The oftentimes the URL will be very close to a real news organization. So it's tricky, I think, for some people.
All right. See, there's the first deflection. It's not all our fault. It's the website's fault. Mike?
Well, when I say our, I mean our collectively, humankind. I'm not saying journalist.
Everybody.
Not saying anything. I mean,
now that's a cop out.
No, it's not. That was the absolute intention of my. It's all of our faults. Collectively, we are to blame for the mess we are in. We're in the La Brea tar pits of news at some points.
The what?
La Brea tar pits. It's where dinosaurs went to get stuck and die.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, but to Julie's point, is it enough to say, yeah, it can be challenging for students, or is it incumbent upon us to recognize that and take pains to really educate much better than we are now?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, starting as soon as people are able to read, so I don't know, 3, 4, when they start reading, you've got to have conversations with kids all the way up about how they distinguish what's important to determine if it's real or not and what's not important to determine if it's real or not.
Yeah, I'm wondering, and it's been a while since I've gone to journalism school, but ask you, Mike, do colleges, universities, do they teach media literacy? Is that becoming a thing yet?
Well, I think the assumption for a long time was that was something that students were coming into, like a school of communication, already understanding. If you want to be a journalist, you understand what journalism is. You understand what media is. I think mass communication classes now are spending a lot more time on distinguishing, what's real, what's not real. What are the motivations for certain, corporate media companies have to make money to stay in business. So therefore, are they doing things differently than people who don't have to do that? There's a lot more critical looking at the media landscape.
Let me grab a phone call, and our first call of the hour is John in Fairport. Go ahead, John.
Hi, Evan. Thanks. I'm calling because I'd like to get an understanding of the view on how real journalism gets translated into social media. And I'll give you the example. I read a story in the Wall Street Journal a couple of months ago about an Air Force general speaking on a panel, was asked if he would follow an illegal order President Trump gave him one. And he answered he would not. And he went on to talk about the various considerations and how generals, certainly senior generals, give a lot of consideration to these kinds of things, and they talk through a lot of scenarios. But there was never an implication in the article that such an order had been discussed or given. Mm-hmm. A few days later on Facebook, I spotted a picture of the general with some bold type that said something like, American general says he would not follow Trump's illegal order. And actually, it was probably a little bit more inflammatory in terms of the way it was phrased. I don't remember exactly what the wording was, but the implication being that some general was revolting against the orders of President Trump. So what you had here was a real story with a headline, frankly, in the Wall Street Journal that caught my eye because I'm a former military officer. The story, of course, was more of a discussion of what the ethical considerations are, the legal considerations are, if you happen to be a general. And it gets translated into something that's totally distorted and sounds an awful lot like something's going on that we should all be concerned about. So how does that fit into the whole topic of fake news? How do journalists deal with those situations, or do we just ignore them and keep plugging ahead?
John, thank you. Very interesting phone call. I appreciate that. And I'm going to start with Mike Johansson. You wrote the post, so go ahead, Mike.
Well, I think obviously, John, and firstly, thank you for your service. Always like to say that to a service person. I think firstly, obviously, you're doing what a lot of people I think would do. I mean, you're questioning it. So you've actually seen the original post. The concerning thing is people who might not have seen the original story and might not understand its origins or might be taking the inflammatory headline out of context. I guess all you can do as an individual is, if you're connected to the person, contact them privately and point out, hey, this is not true. Your inflammatory headline doesn't reflect what he actually said. And if that doesn't work, then you just comment on the actual post itself and put a link to what is actually true. I mean, that's all you can
do. Engage people directly.
Right.
But, he's maybe wondering, well, why is this happening to begin with? Why can't the original story, which is an interesting story, a general saying if he got an order that was illegal, he'd be willing to ignore it or go against it. Why does that morph into and gain velocity as something that it is bigger or not representative of what he said?
Well, it depends on the agenda of the person posting it. Now, if it's
confirmation bias.
Right. So, maybe it's if it's the web person for the Wall Street Journal wanting to goose it up to get more clicks. Mm. And you certainly hope that doesn't happen at the Wall Street Journal, but maybe it does. I mean, it's a Fox-owned company.
That's an interesting point. Let me ask both Randy and Julie about headline writing, because we know a lot of people won't even read stories if they're not sort of brought in by the headline, but you got to be careful there.
Mm-hmm. And even if they are brought in by the headline, they don't tend to always read the story. They kind of flip through. That's our world now. We spend 30 seconds looking at each, thing, and we don't read it all the way through. But it is a headline writing is becoming a science in itself. Largely due to Facebook, because you have to have certain optimal terms in order for it to actually appear in people's feeds. So if you want a news story to actually be read, you have to know exactly what words to use. And we spend an inordinate amount of time, and we even research. We go to Google Trends and look at, what words are resonating at that time, what search terms people are using. And you need different ones for your social media posts versus your web page versus your URL. So it's a big science. And a lot of times when you have a reporter who did the story, did the video, did the photography, and so you get to that social media post and it's not the reporter writing that, and they're just looking at the headline. They might not have time to go through the whole story. So it's someone's quick interpretation of what that story was. So by the time you get to that, it's sort of like, when you go around the room and you're whispering and you see if the same message ends up at the telephone, I think that old game was called, where at the end you see
Who writes the headlines of the Democrat and Chronicle?
Most of the time it's the reporter, but there are times when, and often it will get changed. If it's not resonating, then an editor might change it. So it's typically the reporter's responsibility to come up with the different versions of headlines for the different places it will appear. But other people do have their hands in it at times. And I have myself, when I've written an editorial, sometimes I'll see the Facebook posting of it and it will not accurately 100% reflect. It alludes to what the editorial was about, but it doesn't quite get it the way that the person who wrote it would do it. So there's a lot of room for unintentional things to happen. And John didn't say whether or not it was the Washington Post social. The last one was on the Friends page of the Washington Post, so it's okay. A little unclear.
And we write our own headlines at WXXL.
We write our own. I do, myself and Juan Vasquez, who does a lot of our web engagement work, try to police it and change them as needed. And we're not really necessarily looking for words that are going to hit the metrics, but I think ones that are accurate. I've been myself had stories where I've tweeted, put a tweet to a story that I wrote and have, you know, rightfully or wrongfully been called out by someone on social media saying, hey, you know, your tweet said this, but the story is really about this. Sometimes I agree with the person, sometimes I don't, but people are paying attention to those sorts of things. And I think for those of us in the broadcast world, especially now that so much of what we do is online, we really have to kind of treat ourselves at times as a newspaper and say, hey, what you write is what people are going to remember, even if you edit it later. So that's another consideration, which at least, you know, broadcast, Evan, I know you have some really pithy, wonderful words every day, but sometimes people wouldn't necessarily remember what you said from day to day. But now, a lot of times, I know eventually we'll be doing some transcriptions of the show. So, you know, we've all kind of become one mass of media, you know, video, audio, and people can go back and listen and read and see these things again. I think we have to be careful in how we, again, extrapolate terms, as Julia mentioned, for, you know, for social media, for headlines, and not saying we always get it right, but we try to at least not be sensational to the extent we want people to read the stuff or listen to the stuff, but not necessarily then get dissatisfied because it wasn't accurately reflecting what the story was about.
And that doesn't even get to the fact where you get people who are, have a malicious agenda. And mm-hmm. I think one of the websites I found was abcnews.com.co. Mm. It would take actual ABC stories, repurpose them, rewrite the headlines for the sole purpose of getting traffic. And none of the stories were necessarily accurate. The headlines especially were not accurate at all. The sole purpose was just to get traffic.
Yeah, I think that's a misunderstood fact about fake news. A fact about fake news is that although a lot of political motivations are there too, but the biggest reason it exists is because it's making some people a lot of money.
Money.
And that's through the automated advertising that every time they get a click, they're getting money. Mm. And, you know, I've heard reports, again, I haven't verified them, but that some people are making tens of thousands of dollars a month by having just clickable clickbait.
Well, let's get our only break of the hour. We're going to come back to your phone calls. If you want to call the program, you can do that, 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255. Or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. We're talking about fake news and who is to blame for it. Not talking about stories we don't like, but part of this discussion is how the term fake news has been co-opted to describe that and how that term becomes vulnerable. How good journalism is vulnerable to being tarred in that way as well. So Mike Johansson is a senior lecturer in the School of Communication at RIT, and we will post his post on 6 Reasons Fake News Is Our Fault. We'll make sure we share that on our various platforms so you can check it out. Randy Gorbin, WXXI News Director, and Julie Phillip, Senior Engagement Editor with The Democrat and Chronicle. We'll come back to your emails and phone calls next. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday is New Year's Day, and during our regular Connections Hours, we're bringing you an annual holiday tradition, the Capitol Steps. Always great programming, and you'll have that on Monday. And Connections is back with you on Tuesday afternoon. So until then, Happy New Year. Hope it's safe and wonderful. Thanks so much for listening from all of us at Connections, and we'll talk to you in 2018. Welcome back to Connections. Here are the full list of 6 reasons Mike Johansson says fake news is our fault. I mentioned his complaint that we don't take the time to verify before sharing. And tied to that are a couple of other points he makes. He says, we allow confirmation bias to guide our decision making, and we tend to shut out ideas and opinions that we disagree with. He also says, we often see others, those whom we don't know well, as two-dimensional. And social media, he says, encourages this, making it easier to demonize and disregard the views of others. He says, we are open to the ideas that fantastical stuff is possible. That's why Weekly World News has always thrived. And finally, Mike says, 6, real news and real journalists are a shrinking breed. And that's hard to argue. We're all doing our best. We're not gonna get into a comparison game of numbers, but Mike, that's a hard one. It's a sensitive one because money is part of this and the big media landscape, and we all want to grow our newsrooms. But the reality is, right now, that's hard to do, isn't it?
It is. It is. And you know, with all due respect to the media landscape as it is, I think there's basically a lack of creativity in thinking about ways that news could be better reported, better covered, and better shared. And unfortunately, in stock price-driven companies particularly, those are ideas that are never going to take hold because you've always got to serve the shareholders. And unfortunately, these creative ideas don't really necessarily bring in the high profit margins that shareholders want. So.
Well, let me read a couple of emails here. Ian writes to us and says, "Hi, Evan. I'm in my late 20s, and I feel that many, but not all, from my generation can distinguish between fake news, misleading news, and real news. However, I have found that my parents, both in their late 50s, have trouble distinguishing reputable news sites from untrustworthy ones, and I wonder what your guests think of this." That's from Ian. Turning it around a little bit, because, Mike, you brought up the idea that students may struggle.
Sure, and I think that it's actually true that I don't necessarily think it. I think it's possibly a bigger problem for certain generations. If Ian can distinguish, fake from real, good for him. I honestly think that most people struggle at some point. It's not to say all the time. I mean, I was just saying before we went on the air today that I found this great list of stories, and you had to sort of go through and figure out which was fake and which was real. And one that I was absolutely convinced was fake turned out to be real. And a couple I thought were real turned out to be fake. And I'm a skeptic, as they say, through and through.
There's actually a game you can play, which is pretty telling. I think it's called Factitious. It's online, so look for that. And it was challenging. I scored well, but it was challenging to take. And I think if anyone's interested, it's an easy, quick thing to do.
Okay, Randy, what do you think of Ian's email?
You know, it's funny, and I want to say, and certainly I think I'm age-wise closer to his parents, but of course I'm skewed a different way because I've been involved in media for so many years,
right.
And I'm such a consumer of it. I think I was a born cynic, skeptic, whether that's good or bad. That's probably why I got into journalism, part of the reason. But I can see if people are not online a lot or don't have a lot of familiarity, perhaps with some of the whether it be current social trends or stories that have been out in social media. It's very easy, I think. And even, you know, we have a program, it's more of a lighthearted program on the weekends, Wait, Don't Tell Me, that, NPR produces a great show. And they will do those kind of outlandish, we'll give you three or four multiple choice things. And I'm listening, driving around in the car, and a lot of times the ones that are the most outrageous are the ones that are true. So I think it's frankly easier than we would like to admit that, as Mike mentioned, the story comes across and, you know, you believe it or the ones vice versa, you don't. The only thing you can really do, we talked about this before, media literacy is not for just somebody who's young in school. I think it's all of us. It's just incumbent upon us to read as much as we can, to look at other sources for stories that are particularly controversial. And I think, we're all going to have that issue from time to time. The only thing you can do is educate yourself as best you can.
All right, back to the phones we go. This is John in Rochester next up. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. You talked about Trump in starting this fake news thing. I really admire that he did that because it really gives a defense against the mainstream media, which is overwhelmingly to the left, and they don't report the full story. Not that they necessarily report falsities, but what they don't say says a lot. And I think Trump, I give him credit for using Twitter to combat that. Otherwise, he wouldn't have the chance to defend himself as much as he's able to do.
John, you're going to be shocked, but I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to do something that bolsters some of your argument before I challenge you a little bit. First of all, here's an example of what John's talking about. Newsweek published a misleading headline this past Tuesday that claimed that First Lady Melania Trump demanded a historic Jackson Magnolia tree be removed from the White House grounds. Here was the Newsweek headline: Melania Trump orders removal of a near 200-year-old tree from the White House. You know, and the implication is kind of negative. Like, look at the Grinch Melania taking down this tree. Within hours, Fox News was attacking the story as fake news, basically because it was fake news. And so was the White House Communications Office attacking it. The First Lady did, by the way, order the historic tree to be removed, but only after specialists determined that it was a hazard. The tree has been supported by poles and wires, and they're concerned it could fall down on somebody. So Melania Trump did the right thing. The Newsweek headline made it seem like she is a Grinch. And I don't blame Sarah Sanders or Fox News or anybody who wanted to say, look at the fake news there. I think that does a disservice to all of us in journalism, especially for people probably like John. I imagine, John, that's what you're talking about, all these headlines making the Trump family look bad. And I'm going to agree that that was a big example of how, you know, we in the mainstream media, I'm speaking very generally here, do ourselves a disservice when we are sloppy. But the flip side of that, John, is my concern that authoritarians, and I'm not saying Trump is or isn't, we'll let people decide, but historically, authoritarians have used a tactic of trying to discredit media in general as a way of sowing distrust in media in the public so that the only trust is in the office of government and the power holders. Does that not concern you?
Well, it does concern me, but the fact that take USA Today, take the New York Times and CBS and ABC and the others. Take President Obama as an example. President Obama, they couldn't do enough to keep President Obama in a good light. They didn't report a lot of the negativity that he had created in some of his poor policies, et cetera, in his background. And so he didn't have to combat that bias because the bias was on his side. So Obama, to a large extent, was authoritarian also. Hmm. But he didn't have to combat the bias because it was on his side. Trump, in certain respects, every president has to be authoritarian. That's why they're president of the United States. And so happens, I know you've got Julie Phillips in there who represents Gannett. The Gannett, in a lot of ways, is horrible as far as their bias goes toward conservative viewpoints. And unless you're Democratic, you're not going to get treated fairly.
John, thanks for the phone call. I'll let Julie respond to that directly. Go ahead, Julie.
Well, I think the events of the last year and a half or so have led mainstream media to question whether there is bias, whether there is a, you know, just contextual areas that need improvement, whether we're really connecting with all segments of the population versus the ones that, you know, we hear from most. So I fully understand where he's coming from, that there is a mainstream media rethinking of how we do our job and how we can do it better, particularly in this kind of world where we have access to all sorts of social tools and everything to hear more from people. On the flip side of that, you know, and I have a feeling he's probably written a few letters to my desk. And I often get challenged by people who have written letters and demand, you know, why are you only printing this one side when there's this side and you're not printing any letters that have to do with this side? Well, because that side did not hold up to fact checking. And people don't always want to hear that because we do fact check these letters as best that we can. And if there's something in there that's inaccurate, we don't print it. And unfortunately, a lot of the time that we get accused of being liberal on an issue, it's because we did not receive a factual argument against, you know. So it's a fine line, and I do try to, you know, I think sometimes facts are, it's not as black and white as we would like it.
Okay.
Things taken out of, you know, in different contexts mean different things. So I try to be as open as possible to allowing all those different opinions. So we also get liberally minded people saying, why'd you print that? That's not true. It's a fine line, but I understand where he's coming from.
Micah, do you find something to admire in the way the president has used his Twitter feed to spread the idea of fake news?
Well, this might shock you. I'm quite appreciative of the fact that he uses Twitter so much, because talk about getting inside the man's head.
Oh, I'm with you there. Anybody who wants to peel back the onion a little and show us inside your brain, sure.
Yeah. So that's the good thing. The bad thing is, unfortunately, the world sees it too, and I don't know that it always reflects as well as it could on this as a country. Yeah. But having said that, to John's point, I can see where he's coming from. I mean, it's human nature. There's sort of that theory of cognitive dissonance. In other words, when we see something we agree with, the world's great. When we see something we disagree with, it causes this cognitive dissonance, this discomfort, this feeling of, can it really be right? Can it really be true? And we don't really want to be open or accepting of something that doesn't fit what we already know, what we already accept. So it's human nature. What we have to do is sort of fight that and say, give it a chance. Give it a chance to sort of mature and grow, and let's really look at this from a few different angles. Could there be something of value in what this other person is saying? Hmm. And not enough of us are doing that, frankly.
Just as a journalist, Randy, I would be more comfortable with this or any president pointing out what they perceive to be inaccuracies without using a term fake news, which feels like it's being weaponized.
And you talk, I was going to say, that's the term you used at the start of the discussion here, weaponized. And that is my main concern. I'm not, you know, I don't want to get real political on what I think about, this situation, that. But I think as Mike mentioned this early on as well, as we spoke about this, using the term fake news to discredit media in general, I think does a disservice to a lot of us who are trying to do, hopefully, a well-balanced, well-thought-out, professional job in terms of reporting the news. Not that we're always going to get it right, but we're trying to be fair. I think we try. I think we try to emulate a lot of the standards that NPR uses. If you listen to NPR over a long period of time, just don't pick out just one newscast, they probably have more people of different viewpoints than, frankly, partly because they have the time to do it, than you will hear on other broadcast media, at least. So I think really that the term fake news has been used pejoratively, and not saying, again, that Trump's the first president to do that, but it does cast kind of a pall over people who are trying to bring out the information to people on a daily basis in a fair way.
Julie Philip Rigmore writes to the broadcast and says, can you talk about the difference between a reporter, a columnist, and an editorial writer?
Sure.
By the way, I think this is a good question because I still think there is some confusion in the public about that.
There absolutely
is
confusion.
Which can hurt, especially newspapers.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, a reporter, a journalist, is the person who goes out and covers a story, either, an investigative report or a feature or whatever, and they have to abide by, objectivity is sort of their goal. Whether that's 100% possible all the time, probably not. You know, we all bring bias and perspective into our lives. But they intentionally go out looking to be objective, to present the facts, to make sure that not just this side and that side, but as many sides as possible are presented in there. And the goal is to present the facts, more or less. A columnist is allowed to have some opinion, and that's expected. The columnist is sort of someone who is educated enough to have a valuable opinion, whether you agree with it or not. It's based on fact, but it's an opinion. And so it creates a little more dialogue. It makes people think. It challenges people's confirmation bias that, they only want to agree with. So it's meant to be sort of a mind-provoking piece.
But a column is not an editorial, so an editorial is.
An editorial, and there's confusion here, too, because an editor of a journalist is different than an editor of an editorial. So there's a lot of fine points. Like I said, we've done a horrible job.
You need more terms.
Explain. And senior engagement editor, who the heck knows what that is. But an editorial is the institutional viewpoint. You have a board that has our board. We do, obviously, we can't have everyone's perspective in the community on our board, but we do try to have a wide range of political, ethnic backgrounds on the board. And we take issues that the community is grappling with, and we try to come to some sort of consensus. And a lot of the time that means we sit in there and we play devil's advocate with each other. Like, you believe that, but what about this? What about this? What about this? So usually, and not every single editorial, but typically the Sunday editorials are discussed at length by multiple people doing just that. And I typically write the Sunday editorials, but it's not my opinion, typically. What it is it's a collection of everything that happened in that room and the talking points that we came to and the opinions that everybody held and why they held them. And then my job is to put the facts into that and to present it in a way that flows and makes sense. And if we disagree, which very rarely happens, if we just cannot reach agreement, and this happened with the mayoral endorsement this year, where we were so far apart that we just couldn't come up with an opinion. If there's a couple different viewpoints, strong viewpoints, we might have one editorial board member write an opposing view. And then this is the official editorial board because the majority of the editorial board felt this way. So it's more of a, it's a totally an opinion piece based on fact. But it's sort of the institutional view of people who are have spent a lot of time looking at the issue.
All right, about 5 minutes left and a flood of great feedback from our audience. Rigmore, there will be a quiz later on the difference between those things that Julie Philip just outlined. Dan in Webster on the phone. Go ahead, Dan.
Hey, just wanted to make a point about voting with our dollars quickly. So we've been conditioned lately to consume news that we need not pay for. But what would happen to a news landscape over time if that phenomenon were to persist? You'd end up having a situation where the only outlets that can manage to survive are the ones who don't need to sell their product in order to be viable. In other words, like the only survivors would be the ones aligned with the wealthiest members of a given society, and here you have the corporate media. If you starve journalism and news media of funds from consumers, I think it's quite obvious that the fattest, wealthiest outlets will be the last ones standing, regardless of how reputable or disreputable they are. So, you know, we need to vote with our dollars, and I would just say that I'm not willing to give New York Times my money after I read my five free articles because I don't think they're that great.
Okay. Dan, thank you. Yeah, that certainly you're allowed to have that opinion. But Mike, what do you make of the bulk of that?
Well, I think that's an old dichotomy. I think we're in the 21st century now. There are many, many other ways that news can be financed. And for example, in some countries now, there are not-for-profit organizations that go out and get grants from foundations from both the left and the right. They're in the business of sharing news, but they're not beholden to shareholders per se. There are community-funded news organizations, sort of like a GoFundMe kind of model on a weekly basis. You know, give us your 25 cents, give us your dollar, whatever it is, and we'll turn that into news that you can use in the community.
Where I do agree with him, though, is I do think we're making a decision. If we don't want to pay for any content, there's going to be consequences.
Oh, no, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think I'm afraid that horse left the barn so many years ago that, you know, before my time.
Well, I'll be the last lonely voice saying that if you value print journalism, you're going to have to get a subscription if you can afford it to the Democrat and Chronicle. And if you value public radio, we need you to be a member. I'll be the last voice saying that, I guess. I'll turn out the lights, Mike.
Yeah. But I don't think you need to be the last voice. And I think there are those of us out there who are still contributing as we can. But there is just so much news that's out there that you don't have to pay for. That's the problem. You've got a tidal wave of free, and you've got a waiting pool of pay for. And so that's the imbalance.
And I think sometimes in a lot of conversations I've had lately, and I don't know about you, Randy, but I don't think people totally understand how serious, what the lack of a sustainable plan for supporting journalism. I don't think people, well-educated, very interested people who are very interested in news do not understand the seriousness of the issue right yet.
And I don't think Julian agree with you, and I think people don't understand, again, getting back to the making of journalism, they don't understand what goes into a credible organization, one that will, as we've been talking about, you know, follow up on stories in a fair way, in a thorough way, vet their sources. They think that if there's something for free, and you know, and it's the old adage, you know, you get what you pay for sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I'll obviously, a lot of the things that are clickbait out there come from sources that may not be credible, but people say, oh, you know, if I can read this for free, why do I have to go to the DNC, or why do I have to contribute to public broadcasting?
Right. And especially since our resources have been declining so rapidly as the advertising dollars are disappearing, that, you know, we can't produce as much as we did before. So it almost says, well, I would have paid for it back then. You know, when you had a fully staffed newsroom, it was good. So it's sort of, you're caught in this catch-22 where you're struggling to survive, but you're not producing what they remember and would. Well, I would have paid for that.
We got to be quick because I got to work in one more email. Go ahead, Mike.
So let me propose one thing. Let me propose that all the giant media companies try and experiment with one property, and they can contact me. I can tell you what the experiment is, but it'll actually work, and it won't cost them money, and it'll improve the journalism.
Okay, that's for another day. How about that? We've got a lovely email that I'm going to close with, and I'll turn this to you, because part of what Mike wanted us to think about is, are we culpable for fake news? And I mean real fake news. Real fake news. How do you like that? No, fake news that is manufactured to deceive, and why are we susceptible to it? Well, Bob writes to us and says, Evan, a prominent MIT researcher, did research on why we share on social media, and she found that it primarily is an exercise in social bonding, affirming that we are in something together with those we relate to, that I'm in your group, and we feel the same way. And it seems that this deep human kind of motivation for sharing will, pardon the expression, trump one's concern over strict factual accuracy. So how can we overcome that? That's fascinating stuff, Mike. Yeah. And for me, social media is not really valuable if it's only hanging out in your echo chambers. But the research indicates that's kind of what we do.
Sure, absolutely. And we've sort of started to build community on social, and the way we bond that community is by what we share. And we've gone well past the thing, well, you know, I had a cheeseburger for lunch. Now we want to share something of value, and I use value advisedly, but something we found that we thought others would be interested in, probably something we agree with.
Hmm. Well, I'm with a number of listeners who really appreciated what they heard, sending emails from Jenna Fisher and others who are willing to say when they're wrong. I think there's value in saying, I don't know. I think it's beautiful when we change our minds, and that's not a sign of weakness. And I think I love when somebody who has a different viewpoint than me can pull me along a little bit and we can have a dialogue. That maybe we have to change the culture on social and not just make it about cheering for your own team. But we'll see. I don't know. I mean, that's a big lift. A lot to think about here. I want to thank our guests. Thank you, Mike Johansson, for making us think.
Thanks for having me.
We appreciate that. Randy Gorbin, I'll see you across the hall.
In just a few minutes.
Just a few seconds. Julie Phillip, who is the senior engagement editor for the Democrat and Chronicle, will be reading you in the DNC. Thank you. I want to thank our listeners for a wonderful year. Next time we talk to you, it'll be 2018, if you can believe it. So from John Andrus behind the glass, Megan Mack producer, I'm Evan Dawson. Happy New Year. Talk to you then on Connections.